It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, the CEO of Equifax has stepped down following two massive data breaches. Millions have been affected. What happens now? Plus, David Zubik celebrates 10 years as Bishop of Pittsburgh amidst major changes to Catholic schools and parishes in the regions. In the region, we'll talk about the role of the bishop in a changing religious landscape. But first, the Steelers are among the teams at the center of a debate over politics and protesting the national anthem at football games. Last Sunday, NFL teams across the country demonstrated in different ways, some taking a knee, some raising fists, others, such as the Steelers, waited off the field entirely. All this a response to recent comments from President Donald Trump. Joining us in studio to talk about the intersection of sports and social justice, Sean Gentile from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and WESA's identity and race reporter, Virginia Alvino Young. Welcome back to the show, both of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Glad to be here.
And your comments and questions are, as always, are welcome. You can join us by tweeting those comments or questions and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. So, the Steelers did not take the field for the national anthem for their game in Chicago at Soldiers Field on Sunday. Both of you, let's start off with how's the city reacted? What are you hearing from people? Sean, we'll start with you.
It's been a long week, right? This is not something this is a topic that comes up, I think, more regularly, personally speaking, in my personal life. I think about it a lot, and I talk about it a lot, but there isn't necessarily a lot of crossover to my job as a Pittsburgh sports writer, as you'd think. So the last few days, yeah, they've been long and they've been hectic and chaotic in a lot of ways.
It's been a real mix. What I'm hearing, you have a few sort of camps in terms of where people's reactions are falling, but you have the Steelers' specific decision and the way that it was executed, right? You have a lot of people looking at the same exact situation and being very angry, but for very different reasons. Some people seeing it as being an anti-flag, anti-patriotic decision, which, if you know, language matters here, they say that was not their intent. Of course, none of these protests are about that. Right. Other people, advocates here for equity and African-American groups here, saying no, they didn't stand one way or another. They said that they didn't intend it to be a protest. So really saying they didn't go far enough and being upset about that. Others just confused. What is all of the fuss? Usually I just tune in to my sports games and I don't have to think about politics anymore. So for better or worse, not happy about that.
Did either of you get the sense of, look, I turn to sports for my games, for my sort of relief from reality, my 3 hours of just sort of, let me just focus on the game, the sport itself.
I mean, I personally don't feel that way. I think everything is politics. Sports is politics. Food is politics.
Right. I think people that think that they want that or say that they usually get that are honestly deluded to an extent. The NFL, the Star Spangled Banner, these are inherently militaristic things. The NFL, an inherently racialized arena. 70% of the players are African American, and their bodies are what is being profited from. So whether you're watching a recruitment commercial during intermission, whether you're watching a sponsored
An armed
flag,
forces recruitment
right, a flag display, or whether you're watching your favorite sports stars, you can't escape it. There's an inherent intersection of these issues.
And it's explicit in a lot of ways. I mean, the Department of Defense has spent tens of millions of dollars paying for military demonstrations, just funneling money into sports leagues and sports franchises, really, and that's amped up over the last 6 or 7 or 9 years. So there are really obvious through lines. And to go back to people who say that, you know, I want football to be my 3 hour, you know, respite from the politics of daily life. I mean, that's understandable to an extent, and I don't doubt the sincerity of everybody who says that. But I think even a line like that has been politicized, and I think there are a lot of people who know exactly what they're saying when they say don't politicize sports or stick to sports or whatever. They know exactly what they're doing, and they know the importance of keeping politics out of that, you know, quote unquote politics out of that realm.
And Virginia, you mentioned 70% of the players African American. Of course, the owners are not.
No.
They're white. So, okay. So I mentioned Steelers in Chicago last week. One player didn't stay in the locker room. He was at the edge of the tunnel, edge of the field, end of the tunnel, wherever you want to position Alejandro Villanueva. He asked the team captains about if he could join them at the front of the tunnel at Soldier Field. But then he got separated from the rest of the team. Was this, some people coming off the field? How did this separation happen, Sean?
Okay, well, if you've ever been on the field pregame at an NFL game, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of plates in the air. There's youth groups and there's fans and whoever's singing the anthem and what have you. So the tunnel from the locker room to the field can be a pretty chaotic place. And that was the main factor in what led to Villanueva getting separated. And I take him at his word. He's an Army Ranger and did three tours in Afghanistan, and he's just generally a sincere, comes across as a sincere, honest person as much as you can when you're an athlete and you're talking to sports reporters. So I take Al Villanueva at his word that he didn't, go rogue. He's the last guy on earth to do that. But the facts of the matter are they got separated. The anthem started, and Roethlisberger and Cam Hayward and Tyler Matakevich, who are the other three captains, who ostensibly Al was going to stand with. The anthem started, and they were afraid to walk. They wanted to stay put during the anthem. They didn't want to be seen as disrespecting it by walking around during it. So it was chaos, and really, based on the outcome, it was the worst case scenario for the team, I think.
I mean, what's problematic, is that the execution happened the way that it happened. But what were their original intentions, and what did they reflect on the situation as being? They say their original intention was to withhold taking a stand one way or another. There's the way it was executed, then there's the backlash, then comes a press conference where they basically say they regretted it altogether, and Alejandro Villanueva saying that basically he was embarrassed by what happened. So that's what people need to be thinking about, is this language. Yet that image of him standing alone at the tunnel is what's going to live on probably longer than this conversation.
To me, there were three waves of offending people, or three ways of angering yeah. people. So you had the initial decision to stay in the locker room, which is going to make both sides angry to some extent. Mm-hmm. The disrespecting the anthem crowd, and then the people who said that you're stifling free speech and saying that it was essentially a gutless move, which is what a lot of people did
by not taking a stand
by not
one
taking
way or
any
another
stand at all. Right. And then the other wave of people got angry because of the mis-execution of what they actually decided to do, because you had people that were upset and thought that they left Alejandro Villanueva hanging at the front of the tunnel. And then the third wave of people that was angry were the ones who thought, and there were, I mean, maybe not more than you'd guess, because you can guess that there were a decent amount, but just covering this, the amount of people who thought that Al Villanueva got put up to essentially force into a lie by the franchise to say, like, no, I didn't act on my own. Like, this was an accident, blah, blah, blah. Like, the amount of Al Villanueva truthers who I had to deal with on Twitter were disheartening.
They weren't accepting his explanation.
No. And these, in that, to an individual, they were the same people who were buying Al. I'm sure they bought Al Villanueva. Al Villanueva's jersey was the number one seller on NFL.com for two consecutive days, because people saw him take that stand and were immediately like, this is my guy. This is my...
And it has nothing to do with his performance on the field as a left tackle for the Steelers.
Right, as like a half-decent left tackle for the Pittsburgh Steelers. No, I'm buying number 78 because he stands for what I believe in. And then he comes out literally the next day. He gave as good of an athlete press conference as you can imagine. Talking about difficult things. He's a really smart guy. He's getting his MBA, blah, blah, blah. But he gets up there. He explains what happened. Says in no uncertain terms, I do not believe that protesting the national, that taking a knee during the national anthem is a protest of the military or a protest of the flag. it's for something. It's they have specific out, you know, specific goals. There's a real reason behind this. They are not protesting the military. And to see the people who A, bought his jersey and turned him into this like avatar for, you know, right wing goodness or whatever, they immediately abandoned him. And then it turned, they took away his autonomy. His thoughts weren't his own anymore. He was, of course, being put up to it by the franchise, of course, being put up to it by Mike Tomlin.
A puppet.
Yeah. They totally took away, you know, any sort of individuality he had and really turned on him. And I watched it happen, you know, in my Twitter mentions and in my email inbox and in the comments section of everything I wrote. People immediately dropped him.
Okay. Virginia, so whether the Steelers' plan for last Sunday was executed properly or not, and whether other teams are out on the field and whether they're all standing, their arms are linked, some are standing, some are kneeling, some are sitting, hands together, is it a no-win situation because of all these camps you two have been talking about and they can criticize it, interpret it whatever way they want?
I mean, a no-win for who? Are you saying in terms of like the efficacy of
players? For the players and the teams, is it a no-win for them because somebody will criticize them no matter what?
I mean, that would require sort of getting in their heads with what is their end game? Is it to bring attention to their issues? Is it to stay the most popular players on their teams or whatever? Is it to not tarnish the NFL's reputation? I don't know. But in terms of bringing attention to the issue, all of these seem like pretty good ways. And we're not people who can put contingencies on when and how and where African-American players especially should be allowed to protest.
So let's get to the issue of both where protests are and the original protest by Colin Kaepernick last season that started this. Again, let's start with recap. What was Colin Kaepernick at the time, quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers? What was his message while sort of protesting during the national anthem?
Right. The way it worked initially was during the preseason. He didn't. You know, publicize the decision, but he was sitting on the bench during the anthem. People realized it. The snowball started down the hill. He took an extreme amount of criticism initially. Early on in the process, this is during the preseason, by the way, met with a teammate who was a former military guy. Said that, you know, it would be better for everybody if you knelt and didn't sit. Colin Kaepernick says, okay, absolutely. I'm not going to sit. I'm going to kneel. And it kind of took off from there. You know, he had a rough year. He played for a terrible team. But he's still, you know, he took a team to a Super Bowl a couple years ago. The NFL has a quarterback shortage right now. And Colin Kaepernick doesn't have a team to play for. So you can call it a black ball if you want. A lot of people have. I'm not sure if it's quite that simple. But he's paid dearly after, really, for a protest that started with defined goals and defined objectives, and that was against racial inequality, and it was against police brutality against people of color. That was what he was going for.
Right. And has that message gotten lost, Virginia?
I would say so, based on what we're hearing from feedback from fans and locals here in Pittsburgh. But the thing is, Kaepernick is just the next in a very long line of athlete protesters. You've got Olympic track and field runners in the 60s and 70s holding up a fist or turning away from the flag, being barred from the Olympics for that. You've got tennis players and basketball players. He did not invent using specifically the national anthem. And historically, there is a history of these protests being portrayed as anti-patriotic when they do often carry that same message of being bringing awareness to these grave inequities.
So I wanted to ask you mentioned other sports. So let's take this to now the Penguins have gotten embroiled in this because they will visit the White House. They visited as Stanley Cup champions. A lot of criticism now is on the Penguins and their captain, Sidney Crosby. Is this just a way for people to vent their political views or what?
As far as the NHL is concerned, a huge, huge chunk of that league is Big C conservative. It's an overwhelmingly white, largely Canadian, workforce, obviously. but they politically align with a sort of group that would, you know, say, okay, I'm going to the White House. And then the other element of stuff with the Penguins, the NHL, is just hockey culture in general, where you fall in line, you don't make waves, you don't draw attention to yourself. And so you have those two things combining, which is the politics of the league and the politics of the players, and then just the overall league culture. And of course that's going to lead to the Penguins going to the White House, because it's just a terminal fear of rocking the boat, A, and then B, kind of, you know, maybe a tacit agreement with certain policies there.
Okay, we have just a couple minutes left. I wanted to get a quick answer from this. Do you think that is part of the message getting lost, that players wanted to be vague? The players athletes have wanted to be vague because maybe they didn't want to say that it necessarily agree with Colin Kaepernick, but they wanted to see solidarity. But solidarity about what?
I think NFL owners have defanged it to the point of it's not recognizable to what it was when Colin Kaepernick started it. And I think a lot of that comes from Trump's comments on Friday, is these league owners got put into a position where they had to do something. So they chose to make it about unity and this like nebulous sort of idea. And that took away any actionable step, I think, in a really defined, and it from a defined protest as it started it with Kaepernick.
Solidarity can be really superficial, right? Like, do we care about words or do we care about action? This is a multi-billion dollar league, majority white owners, who is benefiting, again, off of the work and popularity of black athletes, right? And so, honestly, I think a lot of people are saying, sit, stand, whatever. What are you doing as a league to bring attention to police brutality and racism and inequity, that just because you're a more affluent African-American, you are not immune from?
All right. So final question. But the players didn't speak up either when President Trump made other disparaging remarks toward women, immigrants, the LGBT community, and others, until it personally affected them.
Yeah, that's the way it works, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, it was Friday night, and Trump made the decision to take on athletes, essentially, got the pop from the crowd that he needed, took it on to the next day, rescinded the Warriors invitation, because that's who he is. He realized that it worked, quote unquote, to whatever end he wanted it to work, and then has just kind of kept it going moving forward. But yeah, I think they realized. And on an important level, the NFL owners realized that he called out the players, yes, but also called out the sport in general, because he flat out said that he wished it were more violent than it currently is. And they realized that they had a problem on their hands, that they needed to act. So they chose the most anodyne move possible, which is, you know, standing arm in arm and making it about unity and kind of taking the focus off of the inequality aspect of things.
And I mean, when you talk about unity as well, like, what does that mean for the Steelers? This is a team that has had personally problematic players. What do fans want from their players? What do they expect from them as human beings? And what else are they willing to call attention to, as opposed to, again, these somewhat superficial acts of protest or not protest? But do we care about that? Do we care about messaging, or do we care about actions?
Virginia Alvino-Young is social justice reporter for WESA. Sean Gentile is reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Equifax data breach has left millions in Pennsylvania at risk. We'll discuss how the company is responding to their blunder. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The Roberto Clemente Museum is taking donations for hurricane victims in Puerto Rico. The museum is holding an open house Sunday where people can bring bottled water and first aid supplies. And Mayor Bill Peduto says he won't join the Pittsburgh Penguins when the team visits the White House with the Stanley Cup. Peduto blamed Trump's tweets criticizing NFL players for kneeling and protesting during the national anthem last week. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Equifax's CEO steps down. The company's interim CEO apologizes for the massive data breach. The delay in notifying consumers might well be more than 6 weeks. And potential fines on behalf of Pennsylvanians could total $5 billion. We're going to talk about the Equifax mess, its impact in Pennsylvania, but also nationally. And we are now joined in studio by Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Patty Sabatini. Welcome, Patty. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And you're invited to join the conversation. Tweet us your comments and questions. Please use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Let's start with reactions that you have encountered in your reporting of the story. From a local perspective, Patty, what were the questions you were hearing, getting, having to try to find answers for? What were the key questions from people?
Well, first of all, this breach is particularly galling to everybody because you don't choose to do business with Equifax. They collect your personal data. They don't ask you about it, and then they let hackers get it.
Yeah, explain that, because you're if you go to, because there was a Target hack some years back, mm-hmm. But you were the consumer. You were buying something and then using your credit card or your debit card. But here, you in a sense are the consumer. Equifax is selling you and your information to people who might issue loans.
Correct. Anybody that issues credit wants to look at your credit file to see if you're worthy. But again, you didn't ask to do business with Equifax, and they collect your information and then let somebody steal it.
Do we really realize that, in the sense that, you know, we go to buy a car, we're looking for a loan, and all of a sudden it's there, and how do they get all that? Do we really understand who has our information and what they're doing with it, though, I guess is the big question.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people these days understand, particularly with all the hacks going on, that your information can be compromised. I mean, the people that were contacting me mostly were senior citizens who don't have computers, who can't go online to the Equifax site, and even if they're part of the breach. So, you know, I went online for some of them and helped them out, and they just don't know which way to turn. It's particularly hard when you don't have a computer.
And joining us in the conversation right now is Washington Post financial reporter Renee Merle. So, Renee, let me ask you from a national perspective, what's the reaction that you've been hearing, that you've been focusing on, that you've been exploring when it comes to the Equifax breach?
Well, there are several different pockets of reaction. The reaction on Capitol Hill, for example, Democrats and Republicans are both pretty outraged about what's happened. When you think of the scope of this breach, there are probably some people on Capitol Hill who are included in this, and, or you know, have family members who have been impacted by this. And then, of course, I've been hearing a lot from our leaders, general consumers who have been struggling, as your other guest mentioned, with trying to navigate the system that Equifax has set up to protect your data or put on extra layers of protection for your data. The other thing that I've been watching is the reaction from the banking industry. Equifax really is an integral part of our consumer economy. Banks and retailers send them information about whether you pay your bills on time or how much credit you have. Equifax takes that data and puts it into credit reports that those banks and retailers then use to decide whether to give you credit. So they've been watching this very closely as well to see whether they want to continue to work with Equifax. And that's probably one of the biggest risks to Equifax's business going forward.
Richard Smith stepped down, retired this week as CEO and chairman. Renee, I want to ask you, could he have survived if it had, how can I say this, if it had just been the data breach affecting 143 million Americans and not the series of missteps that followed the revelation of that breach?
That's an interesting question. And I have to say, I'm not quite sure. I also covered the, I'm sure everybody remembers when Wells Fargo admitted last year that it opened all these unauthorized accounts for people that they didn't need, millions of people. And their CEO was also pushed out. And what really did him in, if you want to put it in those perspectives, is what happened to them on what happened to him on Capitol Hill when he was just pummeled by lawmakers. Now, Richard Smith is going to be appearing before two Senate panels and one House panel next week. He's going to be pummeled. And so whether he would have been able to survive that gauntlet is pretty unclear to me. You know, even if they hadn't fumbled their reaction to the breach, the fact that it's 143 million people and it includes their Social Security numbers would have been still pretty damning to defend in front of Congress.
I don't think he could have ever survived. I mean, this was so massive, affecting, you know, 40% of the population, 143 million people. I mean, people are saying now that we're no longer going to be able to use Social Security numbers as an identifier. There's so many out there that you just can't rely on that to identify people anymore.
In an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, the interim CEO apologized to people affected by the data breach. Quote, "We were hacked. That's the simple fact. But we compounded the problem with insufficient support for consumers. Our website did not function as it should have, and our call center couldn't manage the volume of calls we received." End quote. So there's the mea culpa, but what do people really want? Patty, we'll start with you and then Renee.
What do they want?
What do they want, Maura? Okay, you apologize, but now what?
Well, one thing they could do is offer free lifetime credit monitoring to people who were affected, and they're only offering it for free for 1 year.
Well, are they offering it for, have they expanded that, Renee?
Well, not free lifetime credit monitoring. What they've expanded and are now offering for free for life is the ability to lock and unlock your credit report. So that you could lock your credit report so that a bank or, you know, an auto lender wouldn't be able to access it. So a hacker wouldn't be able to create a fake user identity and create a fake account. And that's something that they used to charge for, $3 to $10. And now they're going to offer that for free. But free lifetime credit offering, credit monitoring, they're not doing that quite yet.
Is that a step down the road? I don't know. The day the former CEO stepped down, I was talking with the Pennsylvania's Attorney General, Josh Shapiro.
The breach is outrageous, and their corporate behavior in the wake of the breach is outrageous. If we find that there was a violation of state law, that carries with it a $1,000 fine per person and a $3,000 fine per senior citizen. So when you aggregate that together, 5.4 million people with those fines that already exist in state law, you're looking at, you know, a potential massive recovery for Pennsylvania.
All right, so you do the math, and it could be as high as $5 billion, but how realistic do you think those kind of fines are if indeed they violated state law? Patty? And that's one state, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, that happens all the time where they get money. I never see it. I don't know how it trickles down to my pocket.
Mm-hmm. Renee, what I wanted to ask you, Renee, about fines versus, you know, suits, lawsuits. And what do you think about what the attorney general told me?
I think that those numbers are certainly compelling. And I'm sure Equifax already has its attorneys working really hard to settle as many of these cases as they can, because they're facing, you know, literally dozens of shareholder and class action suits, which can really, you know, hit their bottom line. But then they have the regulators, the CFPB, the FTC, and even the FBI looking into this, in addition to the attorney general. So the legal messiness that they're going to have to pick up is really immense. The idea that they could end up paying hundreds of millions of dollars does not seem out of the realm of possibility. If it turns into billions and billions of dollars, then you have to wonder about their ability to go forward. This is about a $4 billion company. If they get hit with billions of fines, I'm not sure they continue to exist.
All right. You mentioned the different investigations. So 47 attorneys general, state attorneys general, are investigating. And Renee, you mentioned the feds. How do they partner together or what? Or are they all separate? Can the feds even Bigfoot the state's attorney general?
My understanding is that they're probably all looking at different things. So the New York State Attorney General is going to be looking at Equifax's response to New York consumers. And so every state is probably looking at different things. What the FBI is looking for is going to be different. The SEC, for example, is also probably looking at this and whether Equifax, in their public disclosures to shareholders, you know, disclose things properly. The FTC is going to look at whether they, you know, protected this data as they should have. So they're all looking at different things. There's going to be some overlap and some collaboration, but part of it is just that they're going to be examined on many different levels from very many different vantage points.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and I want to get your reaction. How the 6-week delay, what if it is longer? The Attorney General Shapiro said that they're hearing that it might have been longer than that, and would that be an unreasonable length of time, and so therefore unreasonable and therefore violating state time, state laws? Patty, what's your sense of, you know, that and whether that could truly impact Equifax going forward?
I'm unfamiliar with the
okay. And Renee, the length of time, how much of a factor do you feel that it'll be it'll play into Equifax's danger, if you would?
If we find out that it wasn't just 6 weeks, that might just be the nail in the coffin for Equifax. I mean, you know, lawmakers are already upset about the 6-week delay. In New York, the New York Financial Department of Financial Services is saying that they want to include Equifax in some state laws that would require them to report a break within 72 hours. So 72 hours compared to 6 weeks, if it's even longer than that, that is just going to amp up the anger at the company. And really, they're going to have to explain why, first of all, they didn't didn't disclose it more quickly. Also, why they weren't truthful in the first place. I mean, the complexity of them changing the timeline at this point is just amazing. And let me be clear, there isn't any federal law that requires a company to report when a company has to report a cyber breach. They just have to do it in a timely manner and let people know. But there's already been talk in Congress that maybe there should be a federal standard in reaction to Equifax's 6-week delay.
All right, Patty, your final 20 seconds. What are you going to keep your eye on regarding this whole scenario?
Well, I would urge people to go onto the special website that Equifax set up, EquifaxSecurity2017.com. Find out if you're part of the breach. If you are, you should consider freezing your credit reports at the three main credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, TransUnion. There's also a fourth bureau called Innovis that a lot of people don't talk about. You should think about freezing your credit there. I mean, that means they can't release your credit report without your permission, and so that freezes out crooks who are trying to open credit in your name.
Patty Sabatini is reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Renee Murrow is financial reporter for the Washington Post. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Bishop David Zubik has marked 10 years as leader of the Pittsburgh Catholic Diocese. Major changes are ahead. We're going to discuss that next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, environmentalist Rachel Carson publishes her most well-known book, Silent Spring, in 1962. The book reveals the harmful impact of pesticides and has been remembered for its poetic literary style and its effect on the environmental movement. Carson grew up in Springdale, Pennsylvania, which is a little over 15 miles north of Pittsburgh. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for September 29th, 2017.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Yesterday marked the 10th anniversary of the installation of David Zubik as Bishop of the Six-County Catholic Diocese of Pittsburgh. We're going to look back a bit at Bishop Zubik's tenure, but mostly ahead to what's coming for the diocese. Joining us in studio is Peter Smith, religion reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Peter.
Good to be here.
And Ann Rogers, general manager of the Pittsburgh Catholic, the weekly newspaper published by the diocese. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You're invited to join the conversation. Tweet us your comments or questions, and please use the hashtag WESAConfluence.
Today, I beg for your prayers, for your patience, and for your participation in the sacred service of leadership, which I will soon begin among, with, and for you. I need you to walk with me toward God's kingdom in heaven, because I really did not expect to be asked to come back to the Church of Pittsburgh.
That was Bishop Zubik, a Swickley native, at a news conference in July 2007, shortly after being appointed by the Pope to lead his hometown diocese. Some background, Bishop Zubik was ordained in 1975, became an auxiliary bishop here in Pittsburgh, appointed by Pope John Paul II to serve as Bishop of Green Bay, there for 4 years before returning home. So Peter and Ann, you've both spoken with the bishop. What is your take on how he views his 10 years as leader of this diocese? Peter, we'll start with you.
He's been very fond lately of quoting this anecdote that when he was on the plane going back to Green Bay after initially accepting the appointment, that he met an ex-Catholic who was sitting next to him on the plane, and the man told him, "I used to be a Catholic, but now I'm a Buddhist. I've never met anyone who actually lived like Jesus Christ." And the bishop has been citing this anecdote in one appearance after another to try to get people to in the church to try to answer that challenge, to live up to their faith, to try to, you know, live it out and express it more.
Yeah.
I think one of the most important things to understand is that this region is his home. He is born and bred here. He's been a priest here for decades. And so these are his people. And that's actually rather unusual for bishops. And he loves this region. He loves all of its people, Catholic and non-Catholic. So he loves this assignment. And he just strives from the bottom of his heart to do what is right for the people here.
Okay. According to the diocese's own statistics, there are more than 632,000 Catholics in the six counties, but the average weekly attendance at Mass is 139,000. The diocese is pursuing a new plan on Mission for the Church Alive, expected to be completed in 2018, well, at least the the mergers of the churches are going to start in 18. Has that been delayed?
No.
All right.
That's been misreported on occasion, not necessarily by you. But so in 2018, there will be an announcement of these various groupings of churches that will all begin working together and be served by one team of clergy. Between 2019 and 2023, these groups will begin to merge over the period of those years.
They're going to give that long to phase in the mergers?
Absolutely. There are some that either because of urgent financial or demographic situations, or because they are already saying, hey, we are ready to do this, will go within the first couple of years. Most of the parishes are going to need like at least 3 years to work through the complexities and find the best way to do this and communicate with their people. And then there's some parishes that have either very complex challenges or they've already been through a recent merger, and they will have up to 5 years.
Is this plan for the mergers, the consolidations, first of all, is it affecting every single parish in the six-county diocese?
Yes.
Okay. Is this a reflection of some of the decreasing numbers, including the number of retiring priests not being kept up with new seminarians? Is it a matter of just the numbers, or is there is there another reason for this overall mission on the Church Alive? Fine.
The most basic motivation is evangelization. We have churches that were structured for when Pittsburgh was a big industrial area built around steel mills. And it's not just the demographics have changed, because we admit we have had failures of religious education and failures of evangelization, and we're trying to correct that. But right now, most of our parishes are spending a majority of their income on overhead. And if they can combine their resources to upgrade things like the music at Mass, hire directors of young adult outreach who really have those skills and do these things that they've not been doing, the goal is evangelization. The goal is to mobilize all of our resources to carry out the message and the mission of Jesus.
Peter, I want you to follow up on that, if you would, in the sense of, your sense of that it's an increased effort in evangelization, because the number, and you did a major story on the bishop's 10th anniversary in Sunday's Post-Gazette. Is it because the numbers of younger Catholics are not there, are declining? There are fewer marriages in the church. There are fewer church baptisms. Do you think that's an extra reason for the reaching out, the evangelization?
That is completely intertwined with, it's a cause and effect. The numbers, there's no way to look at the numbers without seeing them as being really striking.
One struck you most as you were researching and reporting this story? Was it the, decline in those attending Mass? Was it the young people who went away to college, young adults, and maybe not being practicing the faith they were raised in, or what?
Well, we don't have hard numbers for that
right.
in particular, but everyone acknowledges that there is this huge hollowing out of that generation of people, being raised in the church, going away to perhaps to college or perhaps not, and not coming back to church. Now, the statistics that really strike me, Mass attendance, I mean, just since the year 2000, and it didn't start declining in 2000, but Mass attendance is down almost by half. It's almost getting to that point. Some of the sacramental stats, which are sort of what you might call spiritual vital signs, are down by half, like baptisms and marriages or close to it. Those are very significant because marriage is, in many ways, not just getting married, but how you get married is a very religious choice. And it's a reflection of how younger adults are thinking about their faith. In the Catholic Church, you can only be married in a sacred space, in a church. You can't invite your priest to do your wedding down at the beach.
Right.
So not only do you have declines in people getting married, but even those that are getting married, many of them might say, well, let's ditch the religious part of the ceremony. Let's just do a civil ceremony down at the beach. Mm-hmm. And so that is one of the stats that really stands out to me.
I wanted to ask you, Anne, what sense does the bishop have in your conversations with him about younger adults, whether their participation and how he is trying to approach drawing them back or getting more to be involved? And is it issues they're grappling with, maybe issues they disagree with, whether it is, issues about women priests or married priests or anything else?
Yes, the bishop is very concerned. He's doing a lot of reaching out. And we understand that there are many factors that have resulted in young people dropping out. Some of it, national studies show that they're just bored in church, that we've not been offering liturgies that really fill them spiritually. So that is something we're addressing. Yes, some of these issues are important, and the bishop has been trying to dialogue with young people in many different circumstances. Peter covered him going to Theology on Tap, where he's meeting with young adults in an informal setting.
What is Theology on Tap, Peter?
It's where it's what it sounds like. You get together at a pub, and you get a. It's an opportunity for young Catholics, many of them single, to network, meet each other, you know, talk casually, but then have a speaker to talk on some aspect right. of spirituality.
That's not a normal situation where people might expect the bishop. Right?
Yeah, well, I, you know, I mean, he's written about his love for Ubering. So he actually does engage with people in a lot of pretty normal situations. He has some great conversations with Uber drivers. He has this year, he finally went on Twitter. He's at Bishop Zubik. So, you know, he really is making an effort. We've hired a digital media strategist in my department because, frankly, one of our issues has been that, you know, when I arrived at the diocese, a lot of our communications were really stuck in the 1990s, and we were simply missing one or two generations of people that no longer communicated in these very traditional, you know, ways.
So what is he hearing? Okay, you know, you put yourself out there, you might hear disagreements with some of the basic tenets. How does he incorporate other opinions, which might be in 180 degree opposition to what the church currently holds?
Well, he would obviously listen and engage with them. I haven't been party right. to some of these conversations, but I think it is important to note that this isn't just a Pittsburgh Catholic problem. If you look at the stats for the pretty much every diocese in the North and the Midwest, you're going to see similar numbers going down. Other religions often are facing the same thing. A lot of the Protestant churches are asking the same question, where are the young people going? And they are going to some churches, but when you look at the net numbers, you're going to see a lot of falling away from organized religion of all types.
We have just a couple of minutes left, unfortunately. I do want to ask, you know, we've been focusing a lot internally on the diocese and reaching out to young people, but I want to talk about his role. How does he view his role as a community leader, not just a religious leader, but as a spokesperson or somebody that has, no pun intended, a pulpit to talk from about issues, whether it's immigration or healthcare or whatever? We have just 2 minutes left.
Well, he has used that pulpit most recently on administration steps on immigration and refugees. He's been very vocal, speaking in favor of them, especially with efforts to restrict their numbers coming in the country. But he has been, if you try to put him on one side of the political ledger or the other, you'll find him in obviously challenging parts of the Obamacare mandate. So his name was headlined on a Supreme Court case there. So he certainly feels the need to be out in the public square as he sees an issue needing addressed.
All right. And
but he also came out very strongly recently against a bill that would have stripped away a lot of the major provisions of the Affordable Care Act. And he's been very strong also in some statements on racism.
All right. 20 seconds. You decide who's going to answer. All right. The bishop is 68, had some health issues. What do you expect from him near term and long term?
I expect him to stay in Pittsburgh. I don't see any appointments to any bigger sees at this point. So I expect him to stay as long as he can or until retirement.
And Ann, you would think that he would want to stay here. He's not going to refuse, obviously.
Yeah, and normal retirement age for a bishop is 75. And that's when you submit your resignation, and the Pope may not accept it for a year or two or three. So, yes, I would expect to see him here at least probably another 8 years or so.
Ann Rogers is general manager of the Pittsburgh Catholic, the weekly newspaper published by the diocese. Peter Smith is religion reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks so much to both of you.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer is Tom Hurley. Production assistance and research from Courtney Harrell. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.